December 2nd. Oof. LA is blanketed.
I wasn't ready for that.
Frosting of snow.
Glistening. Dun, dun,
dun, dun, dun. The bells are ringing.
I am looking outside and I don't see a frosting
of
snow.
You can see them. You can... I could see them walking over. I could see them walking over
right here.
You just
have to believe,
I mean, there was a moment when like the sun came out after the snow. Uh-huh. And you do feel like you're in this quaint mountain town.
Yeah, a lot of rainbows over the last few weeks.
We saw a good one on Thanksgiving.
Uh-huh. Oh, there's one on Thanksgiving. Yeah. Driving back from Santa Cruz, we saw like four amazing ones because there were all these little like thunder showers as we were going through. Beautiful. Rainiest November in 17 years.
Wow.
2.12 inches.
What can I say? Like, we're due, right? Like, we deserve a little bit of a break, right? There was, like, the big fire that broke out in Santa Barbara County right before the rain. God. Like, that was a really good time rainstorm that came through the state.
And just showing you what would have happened if not for all the rains that we got in November. If you remember a couple years ago when we didn't really get any rain until January, and even then barely any. And had an incredibly huge, devastating fire season all through December. And now it looks like that is not going to happen. And instead, we're going to get an atmospheric river.
Well, now we'll have mudslides for the burn scars. What we want. I think it's okay. And we did, I mean, again, this very low snow line situation. So we had some accumulating snow in some of the high desert cities and neighborhoods. And snow on the mountains above Pasadena, these are things that don't happen very often, or they used to happen more, and now they don't happen as much anymore.
Let's talk about that, because I remember last year, everyone was flipping out about snow in LA County.
Right.
And you myth busted it. Basically,
I ruined everybody's.
Saying that it always snows.
That's taken too.
But this is, but this is unusual, like where it's happening and how much.
I think it's unusual now. It used to be more usual. But yeah, the accumulated snow, I think in Palmdale and Lancaster, they said they'll get like a little sprinkle, a little frosting, but they weren't really prepared to shovel. I think we were laughing before we started the show because they were using just like construction equipment to clear it out of the way because they just don't have, you know, snow plows. So that's great. And it you know, it used to snow regularly-ish in the LA basin.
There was accumulable
snow in like the 40s, I think, the last time here at City Hall.
Yeah, I think you said like 75 years ago we got our last snow in the basin ever. But like the Antelope Valley is basically a totally different ecological region than the rest of LA County. The high desert, it's very different from the rest of LA County.
They get hard freezes, it's higher elevation, but it all has to happen at the same time to get this real snow. So, and then the Grapevine, I think, was closed for a while. Did you try to go somewhere?
Thank God I did not take that route. Last year we did, and just basically had like a Thanksgiving all on its own, just like the two of us sitting on the Grapevine for like 6 hours.
I was actually on the 101 going up to our friends. I guess, are we doing LA stories? Did we even introduce the show?
This is LA Podcast.
The Snow Journals.
I've just got Fraser, Alyssa Walker, and Hayes are here too. Of course, you already know that because we just kind of launched into it. But I went up to like Studio City to a friend's place, one of Sarah's coworkers that was having their whole family get together in Studio City. While we were on the 101, we saw a sign that actually said 5 is closed at Castaic. Take the 101 as an alternate route. And I was like,
where
exactly?
San Francisco.
Oh, man. I feel nothing but pity for the people.
Monterey.
What were your guys' LA stories? What do we got?
I drove. I don't really have one. Go ahead.
You drove where?
Santa Cruz.
Oh, yeah. Well, that seems notable.
Yeah, but it's not notable in the context of LA.
I was excited when one of those rainbows appeared. It was, you know, it was a really rainy, cloudy, dull day, and the sun started to come out, and a rainbow appeared. And at the end of the rainbow was a brand new Metro bike station at the end of my street. It was as if my dreams had been answered. My prayers and dreams had been answered. And I am going to sign up for my discounted Metro Bike annual pass to be able to use this to the full extent. And if you want to do this, it's Cyber Monday when you will hear the show. So use this code SHARE ALL YEAR. Is this our first ad?
Is this
our
first ad? Yeah, and we just got paid off on the show with tap cards. So it's all right out. At least we're transparent about getting bought.
But if you use Share All Year, just today on Cyber Monday, you get 50% off your Metro Bike Pass, which is really exciting because there are probably 10 more stations within the last month that have been installed, kind of filling in this gap from like downtown to almost all the way to Hollywood, out towards Koreatown, all the way down to USC. There's quite a coverage area.
They're doing what they should have done originally.
Right?
Like this was kind of the complaint when Metro Bike got started as a program, these docked bike share things, long before we had any of the dockless bike shares operated by like Jump or whoever else. There were other cities that were doing these docked bike share programs. LA was behind on it. And then when we started, it rolled out in downtown and then like with a separate company in Santa Monica. And then Metro decided to put their own bikes in Venice and then in Pasadena. And it was like, you really couldn't. I mean, if you were absolutely out of your mind, I guess you could take one of those bikes from one of those stations and one of those clusters to another one.
If you were even allowed. I mean, I guess you could have.
I think you could have.
You could have. Maybe take on the train.
Distinctly at your own peril. Yeah. But now, you know, Pasadena pulled out of the program. Harbor City had some of these bikes.
Yep.
They also have a great bike lane network down there, but they also, I think, pulled out of the bike share program. So now we're getting a more centralized, filled in version of this, I guess, in the sort of way that now that the sheen is off of the docked bike share program, nobody has their hand out for these stations anymore, so they can do it in a more rational way. One thing I will say, though, is that if you look at the map of where these are, there is a big, like you said, they're filling in all of these gaps, notably absent from South Central and Boyle Heights. Like, so they're like filling in like the downtown area, but not in the lower income and more minority districts.
I don't know what the story is with Boyle Heights, but I know that there's issues about like around USC about what they can put and where. I guess that's not necessarily South Central, but to get around USC and I think go further south. I don't know what rules they have with them, but you're right. And you also kind of see this pattern of where the infrastructure should go in, because now we have this network of bike sharing hubs. So you can see, oh, that street would actually make a great place. And we are getting some better infrastructure to match. There was the ribbon cutting for the Main and Spring bike lanes. Our first like super
highway. Bike super highway.
I mean, it is kind of fun because you see it goes down through downtown and it goes like around that one of those super narrow, like Flatirony type streets, like at Spring, at the corner of Spring and Main, they come together at like 9th. And it is kind of like a cycle track. You like go around and you can like spin around and head north.
I mean, you're the biker out of the three of us. Like, what is special about these two-way lanes compared to the other ones?
I think it makes it feel like you have a dedicated place that's, to me, if I was going to be cycling with a person, which will most likely be like my children when they're getting ready to ride, it feels like you have a place that is safe and dedicated for you and parking protected. So we have the parked cars on the side separating you from the moving vehicles. Some people disagree with the two-way bike lanes and think that they introduce more conflict or, you know, there's all sorts of trade-offs. I mean, of course, they should be separated physically instead of just having parked cars there. You know, there's things we could do better.
Right.
But I like it just because when you are riding with other people, it's nice to be able to ride next to them or to ride by other people on bikes or whatever other vehicles they're on instead of feeling like you're just squished to the side on, you know, and having like five lanes of cars going by you, which is how it feels to ride on most streets in LA. So
absolutely,
I like the vibe that it creates when you're, you know, on the street.
To me, when I'm like, I actually haven't ridden there, but I've walked over by there since these opened. And to me, what it feels like is the street feels more like a neighborhood street as opposed to just like a thoroughfare for people who live maybe 30 miles away to get through as fast as possible, which is really nice. I think we're kind of, I don't know if it's that we're lucky, but it's interesting the relationship that downtown LA has to the rest of the region where, you know, it's not midtown or downtown Manhattan, where it's just like there are always cars there. There are a lot of times where downtown LA streets are basically empty and can feel a lot more like neighborhood scale streets if we want them to. And I think that this kind of shows that.
And this was went in so fast. There was no neighborhood opposition. Mm-hmm. There was no complaint about taking this very small part of the street and making it for bikes.
Yeah.
And so if the network can grow this way, I think this sets a great precedent for us to spread it out to where all these new bike share hubs are going. And then just sign up for the bike share. Even if you don't only think you'll use it a few times a year, whatever, this is a good deal. I think just to show your support and to help our network grow. And I'm planning on using it more because there's no other options. Also in my neighborhood, they took away all the micro mobility.
Also, full disclosure, the new network connects our three houses. So
yes, and that is power.
And there's your hyperlocal
content.
And
now they're getting rewarded. And the cycle continues.
Thank you for listening.
Wow.
Sort of unrelated Metro news. I saw someone named Freddie Campion on Twitter posting last week that he saw on the Expo line Larry David. Which wow. I feel like means it's really, if you can get Larry David onto the Expo line, yeah. Then Transit has really taken off. He's a New York guy, so maybe like he's more used to it. Can we do some more myth busting around the image that was in everyone's feed all week last week of the white lights on one side and the red lights are on the other, yeah. Going all the way up the 405. I saw so much gloating from people who got to like stay in town for Thanksgiving. I'm glad their families didn't have to move out to Bakersfield or whatever for being priced out. But the thing that always strikes me about it is this image happens almost every single night in Los Angeles. It's probably on Thanksgiving longer, the river of lights down the 405, than other nights. But it really just means that traffic is happening. I mean, that's rush hour, right?
It just means it's Thursday.
It's the only day of the year that LA traffic is news, I guess. So they just want to get out there and capitalize.
So what day was it? Was it Wednesday or Tuesday?
I think it was Wednesday. Could have been Tuesday.
So, but I always thought for a couple of years that it was just people using the same image every year.
It looks like the same image
because
every year.
But then you look and you can start to see very like subtle differences of where we've expanded.
Just use stock video. You don't need to send a helicopter out there.
They're out there anyway. I mean, but this is what I wanted them to do is just go up this Thursday night and film at the same time and show me what that looks like, because I'm pretty sure it's going to look exactly the same.
I like Stu Mundell. I want the best for him. The helicopter.
Dude, just go back on Thursday. Do it again.
And then you get another viral tweet of busting your original one. So this happens every night.
I actually was on my way back into town on Tuesday. Yeah, Tuesday night. So at the same time as all of these tweets were going out, I think actually the first wave of them was either Sunday or Monday last week.
They got like an early start on it.
Yeah. And so I got in at maybe like 9:30 at night. I was so excited because I finally got to use, I'm going to keep calling it Laxit. I don't care what it's actually called. I got to use that for the first time, the bus lanes in the LAX horseshoe. Normally, when my work sends me out of town, they pay for me to get a lift back or whatever. But this time I was able to actually do the flyaway out of the horseshoe because I could actually like see when it was coming and the bus was actually going to get to me. You know, it wasn't 20 minutes after it entered the airport that it got to me. So that was great. I loved it. I got on and it took me only 20 minutes from LAX to the Union Station.
Magic.
Wow.
But I was watching, you know, like as we were going on the 105, you know, all of the traffic that there was and just like this is misery right here, like, but it is an every night sort of misery. It's not special to Thanksgiving. I was very grateful for the flyaway in that moment.
Somebody said it looked like a candy cane, and I thought that was a good candy, like a traffic candy cane, which I appreciate.
Now the flyaway was expanded for the holiday
at Alyssa's request.
Yes. Let's talk more about the power of this podcast. What happened there?
Well, they added just till today, I think the last day is the day you're hearing this show, they added special service to Santa Monica and to Century City. And then they also made transit free for people who were coming out of the airport. So if you left the airport and went to the city bus center or I went to ride the Green Line, although I'm not sure how this would work. It just said, show your boarding pass and get a free ride for free. So I guess if you got stopped for fare evasion going on the Green Line, you just show them your boarding pass and they'd probably just still not believe it. So, but I thought that was a great, those were two really good moves. And I hope it worked well. And I hope people had good experiences getting out of the airport. But that's the kind of stuff they should have announced to begin with.
So the signage was there. That was something that you talked about on Twitter, was that they weren't actually indicating the schedule for Flyaway and they weren't telling people where to board now that they've changed the layout of everything. So when I came in, that was all in place. I know that they had posted pictures of that online as well. It was, you know, considering they're saying something like 250,000 people are going through the airport today, I think today alone. Yeah, I would say that bus lanes are warranted and are very helpful in this sort of circumstance. What I will say is when I got back to Union Station and I discovered that I had to wait 20 minutes for a train, I was pretty pissed off at Metro. But that is not LAX's fault.
Let's talk about some other temporary measures that the city took related to rain this past week. So I think we had mentioned in an earlier episode that even though it was raining, the rainiest November we've had in 17 years, the winter shelters in LA County don't open until December 1st,
yeah,
as a rule.
Right.
And that's a big reason why more people die of hypothermia in Los Angeles than in New York. It can set in at 50 degrees. If it has rained especially, it's very easy to get cold. It's impossible to keep rain consistently out of a tent. So Lhasa actually opened up the Tuesday before Thanksgiving that it was going to open 7 sites early. So open up 271 yeah, more beds, and at the same time open up 100 additional beds on an emergency basis for essentially 3 days. The Echo Park Community Center was one, a few locations throughout the city that would be very temporary shelters just for while it was raining. Great. It was a great thing to do. Got a huge amount of people out of the rain. There was an issue with getting the word out that comes from making this announcement on a Tuesday for that same day.
That same night, yeah.
Information had not even really proliferated around the people who were staffing the shelters. They needed a ton of volunteers that had to show up last second. I was out of town, unfortunately, but we had some people from SELA going around and telling people in encampments that these shelters were open, brought a lot of people to the shelters. But then you would ask people who are staffing the shelters, how long are these going to be open, like for days after the, because it continued raining.
Yeah.
It was much lighter after Thursday, but it kept raining. And people in the shelters didn't know whether they were going to stay open or not. Nobody really knew anything.
If you actually got a bed,
yes,
you wouldn't know that you were possibly going to be turned out onto the street until day of.
You would know that you probably were going to be, but there was so much uncertainty around the whole thing. And most of them did end up closing on Friday, the 29th, although it did end up raining on Saturday as well. It's great to make these services available, but I just saw a lot of reporting. The one reason I want to talk about this is I saw a lot of reporting saying there's hundreds of beds still open at these shelters, which a lot of people, the takeaway from that is that people don't want to get out of the rain. People don't want to go to the shelters when it's raining, but it's really that they don't know that these services are available.
How does the information, how does the information disseminate to the people who are in need of these services? I think that's something we've talked about before, but like without, like you're saying, that SELA is an important, if not essential, link in the information distribution chain here. Groups like SELA are filling a gap that is not being performed otherwise. That's what it sounds like.
Well, SELA also has a system. I'm actually not sure if Lhasa has this, but SELA has a text alert network for our access center. Like when it's open, we closed for a week. It was amazing how effective it was. I was really nervous about this at the time, but we had to not run the access centers for a week a couple months ago. And we usually get like 60, 70 people just showing up. And we put out on the text network for weeks in advance that we were not going to be open on this day. And I went with just some peanut butter sandwiches in case anyone showed up. And not a single person did.
Wow.
Because either you got the text or someone you know got the text and told you not to show up that day.
Right.
So there are ways to, I mean, a significant number of people who are homeless have some kind of cell phone that they can receive information on. and just like a way to like be a part of a Lhasa alert network. I'm not sure if it exists.
Well, this is just what is kind of, I think, a little bit weird to me is, I think that you would know if it existed and it was, you know, if it existed in some real sort of way that it was actively being used by a lot of people in the homeless community, I think you would probably know about it. And also, how did this decision get made? I think it's great that the beds were opened, but like, we talked about this and we recorded last Saturday. So it was well known that it was going to be heavy rain during the holiday week. Decision was made day of the arrival of the rainstorm. I just kind of wonder, like, what was the decision making process like, and how did they expect that people were going to find out and get into the shelters wherever they might have been open?
Why aren't these open all year round anyway? There's like heat, there's like smoke in the air. I mean, there's right, all sorts of reasons that we should have these open and all seasons.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, the way it happened in this case was it went through the council. It was Mike Bonin's emergency. He and Paul Percorian put through an emergency measure that got approved, I believe, on Tuesday.
Yeah.
And so then everyone had to like spring into action to get these open, which they did. Look, I mean, this is like city speed is incredibly slow.
Yeah.
The fact that these were able to exist at all on such short notice, staff up and get like any number of volunteers is impressive,
right?
But it should have at least happened earlier, and at best just be open all the time to account for, like, even if we got to half the number of beds available for the number of people who are homeless in LA City and County, that would be way, way better than where we're currently at.
Checking in on something else that we've talked about at length in the past, something that directly affects the ability of people to take shelter from events like this. We have 85.02 up for renewal again.
Yes.
Mike Bonin, former guest on this show, has already said that he no longer supports the extension of this city ordinance, which is the ban on homeless individuals being allowed to sleep in their vehicles, something that is important if you're at risk of hypothermia during winter storm events. So this was put forward, I believe, by Krikorian or possibly Blumenfield.
It was Blumenfield.
Okay, Blumenfield.
So to reopen it. To extend 8502.
To extend it for another 6 months.
Now it's got to go through the homelessness committee, and then it'll go, assuming it'll pass out of that, it'll go through to the council floor. I predict that it is going to go down.
I think that during the last extension period, we saw a large number of activists come out, speak to the obvious problems that this causes for our unhoused neighbors. The city council infamously ignored all of that testimony and voted to extend it. I kind of agree, Hayes. I think that it will be harder for them with the momentum that is still being built and also during winter to extend 8502 again. But it will be important for people, listeners to this show, to be vigilant to that as it moves through the council process.
Let's talk more about some very big news in the city council this week. Herb Wesson, who has been the president of the city council for quite a long time, announced that he was stepping down, and he put forward Nuri Martinez, council member from District 6, to take his place as the president of the city council. This is a big deal. Herb Wesson was termed out, and he's been running for county supervisor. And so we knew that he wasn't going to occupy this position forever. But the fact that he's getting ahead of it and abdicating this position before he even leaves office is a big deal. Nuri Martinez had been my guest for the person that was going to take his place. She's been vice president of the council for a while and kind of runs the meetings when he isn't there. But Herb Wesson is sort of a singular figure in terms of how a very, very tight control he has had over this 15-person body. Talk about Herb Wesson's significance in this office.
So Herb Wesson has been the president since 2013, I believe. Is that right? He's been there at least since the beginning of this decade and had a major impact in the way that redistricting went forward after the previous census. He has, like you said, exerted a huge amount of control over the members of one of the most powerful municipal legislative bodies in the country, to the extent that it's almost newsworthy when city council does not vote unanimously on something anymore.
Let's right. talk about that. I actually, not knowing that this was going to happen, I had a friend, Chris Brady Denton, who is good at this stuff, put together, just run the numbers finally on how often city council votes unanimously. This is over the past 5 years. So it was 2012 that Herb Wesson took over. But this existing city council has more or less been in place since 2015.
Right.
Monica Rodriguez is new. John Lee is new. But like more or less, like this is like it's had the same shape for the last 5 years. Would you like to guess? So the total number of votes in this time was 26,141. Would you like to guess the percent of the time they voted unanimously?
Now, does this count if some of them were not there?
Yeah, just so a 13-0 vote is a unanimous vote. Okay. There almost always is somebody missing.
I'm going to say 85%.
Okay.
I was going to guess like 99.1%.
I'm going low, perhaps.
Okay.
26,000?
26,141 votes.
1% is, I do not believe that they've disagreed 250 times.
I think I'm low, but I'm going to.
You are both too low.
Oh my God.
The number is 99.37.
Wait. So we can literally discuss every single vote that was not unanimous and have more time on the show.
So some of those are unanimous no's. 0.05% of the time there was a unanimous no. But unanimous yes is 99.32%.
How does something that's a unanimous no even get
yeah, right? Well, that's a Herb Wesson thing. Like right, for the right. most part, he'll only do it for the dramatic gesture right. of everybody knocking something down.
This, okay, yeah. So I mean, we need to probably devote a whole show to this another time. But like, is that normal or healthy or is this that, democracy? I mean, what
I would
is
say
this?
It's not normal.
So, in their defense. A lot of stuff that goes up before the city council is whatever, fixing a stoplight or and stuff, the stuff that just sails through.
Uh-huh.
But nowhere near the amount of unanimity should be expected from this group of people who are very divergent in a lot of different yeah. ways. They're not politically consistent at all in the way that they speak, in the way that they like advertise yep. their politics. One of them has been a Republican for this entire time. There's absolutely no reason for them to agree this frequently.
Only 4 out of 5 dentists support flossing. Only 93% of Republicans support Trump. Like we're talking yeah. about 99.1
like, is the move here
or 99.3% agreement. Is
if you don't agree, you don't show up for the vote as to not like cause a problem. Is that like what you do here in our city of angels?
That does happen. That does happen. For the most part, it doesn't come up for a vote at all unless everyone agrees. This does precede Herb Wesson being council president. There is this culture of just an automatic yes vote that is reflected in actually the technology that they use to vote.
Right.
So I didn't realize this until a few months ago. Emily Alpert Reyes, the LA Times reporter, shared an article about how the way the voting machine works is it votes yes automatically unless you are there to vote no.
What?
And so they actually could be replaced with an automatic yes voting machine, and in many cases already have been.
That actually hurts my head. I had no idea that was the case.
I think Alice Walton on Twitter told a story about how Tony Cardenas having to race back to his seat to try and vote no before the machine automatically voted yes on something, but the hummus line at the backstage it was too long, so he's standing there tapping his foot waiting to get a snack and then had to sprint back to vote no on this thing. There have been many other examples. Like I saw recently, David Rue voted yes on Mobility Plan 2035 and then afterwards said he meant to vote no.
Oh my God.
But wasn't in his seat when it happened.
Well, that was one of the few votes that was not unanimous.
That was not you. There were a couple other no, but Paul Koretz voted no on that as well, the bike and bus lane implementation. We also, there was a story recently that Rob Kwan, an activist, was talking before the city council and then realized he's like, hey, you don't have enough people to have a quorum right now. There's only like yeah. 5 people sitting in their seats.
Then a bunch of people got out of the hummus line and came back.
Right, that's exactly what happened. And Joe Boost guy, you know, yelled at him first and told him
for being off topic.
Yes, and said that he had to be escorted out. And then, very like with a big sigh, people made phone calls and like whatever.
It was like they didn't even.
Three people just like dragged their ass back into the
seat. $210,000 a year, your city council member.
But that, like, to me, that also makes how often they're absent more damning, because you don't, right. You can just sit there and a machine will do your job for you.
So if you are, for example, Curran Price, and you happen to nod off because things are not that interesting, you will still get recorded votes as though you were paying attention.
That's right. Curran Price counts as being present while he naps through the entire proceeding.
That's fine.
So he really dug into the numbers on this. Between specific council members. But the reality is there is, because they vote yes so frequently, there's so little divergence between them. There's no real, like there's some interesting individual votes, but for the most part, everyone is just in lockstep on everything.
Like in baseball, they have value over replacement. You should just have like replacement with a just individual clicker that just says yes, which is exactly what they are.
Yeah, the number of no votes for each of them is in the low double digits over this time. So that, I guess, is the significance of a new council president. Can you maintain that system?
I would say
Herb West's numbers are pretty good.
That is absolutely the significance. And you have to imagine that Nury Martinez is being put forward by Wesson as the person most likely, or at least the person tasked with continuing this system of everybody agrees on everything. That is the way that benefits the council members, is that is what allows people to get their individual pet projects forward. That is what allows people to rule their own districts like their little fiefdoms, because everybody just says, I won't disagree with what you want to do in your district if you don't disagree with what I want to do in mine. Everybody has each other's back in that way. So it is Nury Martinez's job now to try and continue the Wesson system. And it should be everybody who cares at all about good governance in the city of Los Angeles's job to make sure that she's not successful in that, I would say, because it's incredibly damaging to the fabric of our city as a whole.
And I get, part of it is also like you were saying, Alyssa, people don't show up if they're going to vote no. That's something that should probably start to change as well. And maybe, well, I'm very curious, when 8502 comes up again, we have a council member on record, Mike Bonin, who said that he doesn't support it, was not there for the last meeting to vote no. So at the very least, having someone there speaking out against this, I'm sure there's going to be huge turnout to see what happens. That's the kind of thing that could get, but there's some guaranteed yes votes on the council as well. So if you're going to try and get to 8 no votes, which I think is totally possible, it requires some of the council members showing up to speak out against it. Let's continue talking about Herb Wesson. He put out an ad this week for his county supervisor campaign that was unlike any ad I have ever seen before. Scott, would you like to talk about this?
That's a really nice way to describe it.
I mean,
so Herb Wesson put out an ad. This is for his bid to replace Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas in their effort to swap seats with one another that we've talked about before on this show. So Herb Wesson, going for the second supervisorial district of the county, put out an ad where he is going around Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles, and he is looking for his stepson, an adult named Doug, who has suffered with addiction to cocaine, to crack cocaine, and is living generally as a homeless individual now. So I guess
on and off, he's spent like
on and off over a period
even
of time.
Years being housed, but then ends up back on the street.
Narrative of the ad is given by Herb Wesson's wife, Doug's mother, who is talking about how Herb goes around every Thanksgiving and tries to find their son so that he can spend Thanksgiving with them. And Herb Wesson says, you know, sometimes he's successful, finds him, they have Thanksgiving together. Sometimes they don't. It is a very affecting story. It is, I would say, I don't know. I when I was watching this ad, I was unable to divorce myself from the raw politicization of not only his life, which of course he's consented to over a period of many years and mm-hmm. decades, but also the life of his son, of his stepson, who presumably has no knowledge that this is even happening, right?
Yeah.
It seemed to me very cynical.
Maybe at this point he does, but as when the cameras are showing up, I'm sure.
Yeah, so they have a whole camera crew. There was actually a columnist in the LA Times.
Sandy Banks,
who wrote about the cynical nature of bringing a camera crew with you as you shoot a tearjerker sort of story through Skid Row among some of the worst poverty in our country. And you're doing it with the intention that people will see you as a family man, as a father first, who wants to go on to this extremely powerful position in county government. In that light, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how you guys saw it. It seemed to me wholly unnecessary. I felt like it took a story that would be extremely affecting on its own merits and turned it into something that just felt a little bit nasty, yeah, to me.
Yeah, I was very put off by it. The tone seemed like it was staged, and in a way that was, like I said, you wondered if this stepson had ever known that this was happening or had the ability to know that this was going to happen. Mm-hmm. It felt very exploitative to me, and it was just troubling, especially when you are a person who has a lot of the tools at your disposal to fix this problem, and you're walking through the problem. And why would I vote for you for county supervisor?
So here's the thing: is that he's got president. There are, so if we're talking about Wesson, you know, he has over the course of the past however many months, as he has started making the case for himself as supervisor, he has started to put himself forward on a lot more progressive issues. Last year, we played mm-hmm. a clip from Wesson where he was talking very passionately about the siting of homeless housing in his district. It was clear at that time that it had a personal importance to him. It's the kind of thing where I feel like context is so important. And who is this ad really for? Like, when you think about it, I feel like it is... That is what makes it seem a little ugly to me.
Here's a question. Did either of you know about this, this issue with Herb Wesson's son? Did you know?
I just knew about the other son.
I knew about two of the other sons. We talked about Herb the third recently, not getting his rent raised for political reasons. His son, Justin, has had a few minor scandals over the years, including he got the LAPD to provide security for his wedding and then had to pay that back. To me, the thing that, I showed it to like family members over Thanksgiving, and they were universally like very moved by it.
Right.
And kind of saying, but you know, in the context of like not knowing who this person is, just a video about him going out to find his son on Thanksgiving is an incredibly affecting story.
Yeah.
It would be one thing if he had used his personal relationship to this issue to advocate for homeless services over the years. Like you were saying, Alyssa, he has the tools at his disposal to do something about this. But like you were saying, Scott, like we've played clips of him talking about it very passionately. He's a very charming, charismatic figure in a world of LA politics that does not have a lot of those.
Yeah.
In the video, when he skips, when he sees his son, you're like, it's very charming and moving. But the fact that this is only being brought up now for the first time in an ad for him to be county supervisor undercuts bravery and sincerity from like him opening up and being vulnerable about this very personal issue. He does not have to talk about it ever.
Sure.
Like he's under no obligation. It's a totally personal thing. He does not have to speak up about it. But the fact that he's doing it for the first time in an ad and not as part of his advocacy, I think, is what makes it not.
It's opportunistic.
Yeah.
I think, and so I think that, you know, and you can say all politics is to a degree opportunistic, and I would generally agree with that. But the thing is that we have seen Wesson move considerably on issues that he's had power over for a long time. We're almost 8 years into his term now. He's stepping down as council president, but it's been 7-8 years now. So he has moved on issues of homelessness. He's moved on gentrification, going so far as to cancel the district square project in Crenshaw, mm-hmm. saying that it would, if it's not affordable to people who live in that area, then it shouldn't be built. But the fact of the matter is, even though that's good, that is new. So I think he's responding to pressure from the constituencies that will be voting for him for supervisor. Again, responsiveness to a constituency is much better than the alternative, which is something we also see a lot of here, inability to respond. But that being said, it does feel opportunistic when you say, as I was asking earlier, like, who is this ad actually for? I would say it's for the people that you showed it to, Hayes, over the course of this. It's not for people who are actively engaged in these spaces.
Yep.
It's for people who have no name recognition of Wesson at all and who will look at this and this will be their first introduction to him, mm-hmm. which does make it feel to me more baldly opportunistic. And which does, if I'm looking at it in that light, if I'm seeing that as a cynical move, which I do, then it also makes me look at the other movement that he's had in his political stances also equally cynically, just in general.
Yeah. This is a prominent office in LA and California politics. The president of city council prior to Herb Wesson was Eric Garcetti. Prior to that, it was Alex Padilla, who, I mean, he was 26. He's only 46 now.
Wow.
But he is now Secretary of State of California, is on the short list for like the next like a Senate run, like a Senate pick. Eric Garcetti's obviously become a lot more prominent after getting this role, was also kind of a wunderkind in that office. So it's a big deal for Nuri Martinez if they follow Herb Wesson's lead and make her president of the city council, which they will because they vote unanimously 99.37% of the time.
Foregone conclusion.
But won't it be nice to have a woman to be the president of our city council?
Yes. The last one was Ruth Galanter prior to Alex Padilla more than 20 years ago. Let's talk about these bus shelters and a contract that was not renewed after a lot of deliberation.
Was it a unanimous vote?
I must have been. Oh, let me check, actually. That's worth checking.
I think it
was.
It
would not have been part of the numbers that we ran.
Right.
I would be actually way more shocked if anybody on the city council felt strongly enough about this contract to go against the grain on it.
Let's talk about it. What happened?
Okay, so we actually talked very recently about this Outfront JC Deco contract that provides for all of the city of Los Angeles's street furniture. It was a long-term contract in the, I believe, late 90s or early 2000s, 20-year contract that is expiring soon, and there was an effort by the company to get the city of LA to extend it without going back out to bid for other people to fulfill the street furniture needs that the city of Los Angeles has. We talked about this recently because I would say very few people, and especially not transit riders, are happy with the state of street furniture in Los Angeles. When we say street furniture, we're talking about benches, we're talking about trash cans, we're talking about bus shelters, all of these things that are used by people who walk around the city every day or take transit here every day. But during the course of the life of this contract, were not really a priority of either the city or apparently the contractor who was fulfilling it. So now we have this contract expiring. City Council, I think it was really unclear what they were going to do here for a long time. It seemed, I think earlier in this decade, it seemed like they were going to just extend it. But then during the course of this past week, they had the city council meeting. And they actually came out and said that the city council was not satisfied with the way that the contract had been fulfilled or with the terms of the contract. And so they were actually looking to change vendors. They were looking to change the way that the bus shelters and benches and things would be rolled out going forward. This is good news, frankly. I think that there's a healthy bit of skepticism regarding what will actually come of this. It's hard to say at this point, but the fact of the matter is, the existing contract, based on what it was able to deliver for Angelenos, should definitely not have been extended. There should be a wholesale consideration by City Council of what our next, 10 to 20 years of street furniture provision needs to look like. There were interesting quotes that came out of this. Gil Cedillo got noticed by saying that he was unhappy with the hostile architecture of the benches that are in place at bus shelters.
I want to like.
It's not that hostile, and I
feel like it is.
Well, I mean, it's I totally agree that like a lot of our architecture is hostile.
Yeah, right.
But I can't believe that this person who has not stepped forward for bus riders and bike riders and people who walk in the city is all of a sudden
he has stepped forward
just to vote
to put
no
a stick in there
no. But I just can't believe that all of a sudden he's bringing this up now, and when this has been the case for decades, probably. I don't know. Remember the bus benches before this, which are those like plastic, like turd, brown turd things that were like, you couldn't even like sit on them. You would like slide off to the ground. But I just was so angry. Like, he does understand that people use these to sit, to wait for the bus, right? And and to complain that they're like hostile to a certain group without acknowledging that they're not at every bus stop and we need them at every bus stop was insulting to me. I felt like my kids sit on those. Like, I need those for my kids. Like, if I don't have that at a bus stop, they have to sit on the ground next to like cars going 40 miles an hour.
I thought he was saying that about the armrails.
He was saying the armrails on the bus shelters are bad for people who are homeless because they
can't. Well, I want to get the language on this exactly right, because I saw different representations of what he said. He was saying that the armrests were uncomfortable for people just waiting for the bus and sitting there. Like, they don't, they definitely don't function as armrests.
They suck.
They have no like functional purpose. He said that like he realized that they had been put in there with the intention of stopping homeless people from sleeping there. But then he said that it had not been his experience that that worked.
Okay.
There was so much there to unpack. I mean, but I was just so struck by bringing this up when the first and foremost goal of this program is that we would have had a bus shelter at every single bus stop. And we do not. And to even bring up
25%
that there's, now we have to wait until 2021 to have a new RFP go out, have another company propose something else. Does this mean that our progress is halted? Like, are we stopping this? Are we, do we have to like reevaluate every site again?
You would think if, I mean, so just by virtue of, I don't know if they are out front, JCDecaux, I imagine they are still going to try and win whatever the subsequent bid is.
They're very active in LA city politics, as evidenced by they follow me and I assume both of you as well.
But so I would say, I would imagine that if they are trying to win whatever subsequent proposal goes out, that they would be more incentivized to continue fulfilling the actual letter of their existing contract going forward, unless they feel like they absolutely can't win it. That would be just my speculation, though. But yeah, I don't know. I guess I was happy that there was an acknowledgement from city council that the existing bus benches were intentionally designed.
But didn't they vote for those a few years ago? I mean, is it just now dawning on them that these are not okay?
I don't know.
He said they were uncomfortable for seniors and other bus users.
Right.
So, and he said that they didn't work to deter people who are homeless. So I saw a lot of people saying, good for Gil Cedillo for getting out ahead of hostile architecture. And like, to some extent, that quote implies that it just wasn't hostile enough to work.
Right.
Yeah, that's the way I took it. I don't even know. Like, there were other things that were said. Like, Mike Bonin said nice things about like making sure that we had better places to wait and increasing ridership, things like that. I just found it like almost laughable, this conversation about all of a sudden we realize maybe you'd need a better place to sit. And meanwhile, the city is like launching like a zero emissions roadmap for transportation when bus shelters are not part of that in any part of the conversation. Uh-huh. We're having a competition to redesign our streetlights, arguably the one part of our street which it doesn't really contribute that much to the people waiting for the bus or needing shelter, needing shade, like all these things. Like, yes, we need more streetlights. We need to be safer walking around at night. Like, that's great. Like, that. So it's wonderful, but
the question is, I guess, like, is the next contract going to be any different or better? And what would need to be done in order to make it be better? Is this something that even needs to be contracted out? Like, I don't know that I really get it. Like, we have the Bureau of Street Services. We like, they put streetlights up everywhere.
Have made cool furniture or different shelter type things when needed. That Hoover bus shelter the bus plaza that we were talking about, they put up beautiful shade structures. Mm-hmm. There's benches there. It's a nice place to wait. I mean, I'm going to enter this streetlight competition and just like upload my streetlight, which is just a bus shelter, and it has a place to sit, and it has like a tree attached to it, and it has a light on the top of it, because what we need is like all these things, and we know how to do it. Why are we putting out RFPs, and why are we having competitions?
I guess I'm really torn about this, because this is an area where we are so terrible about, like, this is the worst experience of like being a pedestrian, is trying to just like have the basic pedestrian infrastructure. Somebody that I follow on Twitter put up a request that they had submitted to LADOT for a crosswalk in the Silver Lake area, and were told that like there weren't enough people there to actually make it worth their time to paint a crosswalk. So that's how the city treats these. I'm like thinking, would it be good to have the ability to submit a 311 request and say there should be a bus shelter here, and the city would actually do that rather than a contractor?
What
but maybe they wouldn't do it.
Yeah, maybe they wouldn't.
Maybe they would just respond and say, you know, tough shit. See you in 2041. I don't know.
Well, I think what we should you should be able to know at whatever location, like exactly that, like what's the list of like crosswalk requests? What's the list of bus shelter requests? Like, is this all transparent in a way that we could find out what's being prioritized and why? Because clearly, I mean, I've requested things for months and months and months at on certain streets, and you don't know unless you actually tweet it, like,
yeah,
right. And they do respond. Like, is that how our city is supposed to work, that you can like just tweet at the private contractor and ask them questions? I mean, it's just, it's just baffling. And if one thing that we could prioritize is just getting as many shelters in place as we can, especially, it's not just about sun, the rain this week, waiting at the bus in the rain this week is like really bad. It's mm-hmm. like really a horrible situation. And I'm sorry that people, you know, are, I don't know, whatever is wrong with the contract or whatever isn't going well for the city council, that they have to change the contract, but it's their fault.
I mean, ultimately, yes, it is nobody else's fault but the council. And that's why you kind of have to wonder whether or not anything will be different this time around. Hopefully it will, though.
Got you talking about how they don't contract out streetlights gave me and probably Bureau of Street Services an idea for they could put out a contract for advertising that is projected out of the streetlights onto
that's probably
the sidewalk
going to happen.
For your consideration, Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
That is definitely going to happen.
A few dollars on each of the streetlights. Let me see. Are there any other stories that we have to cover? Huizar! My aide is a whistleblower. Oh, I'm so excited to get back into this. Jose Huizar, back in the news, is getting sued. Actually, the city is getting a $10 million lawsuit from one of Jose Huizar's aides, who alleges that he was fired for talking to the feds about his suspicions that Jose Huizar and his chief of staff, Paul Habib, were involved in soliciting bribes, extorting money from operators of cannabis businesses. This was written up by David Zanizer at the LA Times. Is an incredible, multifaceted story. We have talked about in the past the possibility of corruption and malfeasance from these weed licenses because of the way the city council has seemingly intentionally decided to distribute them by setting caps on the number of licenses that are given out in the city and then giving themselves individual discretion.
Yep.
So this is what's so amazing about it. We talked about how they vote unanimously almost every single time. It doesn't have to come up for a vote when they give out one of these weed licenses. They can just dole it out from their office.
Yeah.
So even the 99.37% is not safe enough.
No.
For them to give these out. And a cannabis license in the city of LA, because of these caps, is incredibly valuable. It's like this priceless item.
Plus, you're forging the relationships that will govern your post-political career when yes. you want to go join the MedMen board, like
exactly.
or whatever.
So this money is affecting all kinds of LA City Council politics. It's basically what got us the push for a public bank.
Yeah.
That was a place to put this weed money. It is underperforming, by the way, statewide. There would like people are not buying as much weed on the legal market as people were expecting that they would, but it's still enough to have all the council members going crazy for it. Also, go through any of their donations and you will not believe how much weed money is.
Can I just say, I think it is a delicious irony that the
it's a dank irony.
dank irony that the existing black market for weed in California is possibly the only thing putting the brakes on the ongoing cartelization of local politics. Wow. Love it.
Wait, does this mean we rename this segment Weed Czar?
Yeah, Weed Czar. C-Z-A-R.
Weed Czar. You're too good at this. This is a juicy
So sash. Here's what amazing. Here's the most amazing thing about this lawsuit. Jose Huizar and his chief of staff, Paul Habib, have alleged that Jesse Leon, the staffer who is now suing the city, was actually in charge of writing this ordinance that allowed people to apply for cannabis licenses as he and his wife were applying for one of these licenses.
Oh my God.
With the office, presumably, that he works for. So something of a conflict of interest there. And apparently, Huizar says that he fired him, that he fired Jesse Leon for that reason. But there is a question in my mind of like what it means that a council office, this kind of thing was going on in a council office. Even if that is true, it's incredible corruption happening. And that didn't like get out in the news, that he just fired this guy and sent him on his way. This guy who is, of course, still on the city payroll. Don't worry. He's still being compensated after being fired months ago. And makes $101,000 a year as a council aide. He had applied to be a social equity applicant, which is this designed to assist marijuana entrepreneurs from communities who were affected by the war on drugs.
Right.
Not necessarily intended to go to the staffers of the council members.
Yeah, this is sticky icky. Honestly, though, this gets back to the original. Before we actually started talking about the Huizar, the Say It Ain't So stuff with the FBI investigation, the first round of corruption surrounding the Huizar office was all about retaliation.
That's right.
It's hard to even remember at this point because it almost immediately got overshadowed. But
retaliation for allegations
of sexual harassment.
Sexual harassment.
So Huizar had credible allegations of sexual harassment in his office, and there were credible allegations of sexual harassment in Huizar's office, and there were also allegations that he had retaliated against both the women involved and also against other people who he was apparently disfavoring because he was trying to boost up people that he was having relationships with inside his office. So this sort of retaliatory behavior seems like it is in line with what we already know about Jose Huizar's office. The whole thing is really gross, right?
Yes, and also I want to point out, neither of these things were what he was raided by the FBI for, ostensibly, which were kickbacks from developers downtown. I mean, that was what it, like, the FBI hasn't come out and said it, but that seemed to be, based on warrants and stuff that they were putting out, what they were mostly focused on was real estate, which raises the question, like, what does it take to get someone to resign? Just say that you have a lobbyist job, you know, just like what?
Pretend you want to go into sports marketing.
Yeah.
Where is the district attorney? Like, you know, like what is happening in CD14? Like that you could have multiple sexual harassment allegations, multiple retaliation claims, just on the basis of employment, like something is not right with him as a boss in this case. But it seems like he is going to successfully ride this out to the end of his term. We have no updates to give you on the FBI investigations,
which were now over a year ago.
Yeah.
But the initial raid took place. Yeah, what you're saying about even on the basis of like how you staff your office, there aren't that many people that work in these offices. And I can now name like half a dozen who are basically suing the office for one reason or another, or who have whistleblown for various things, who Huizar has then said about each of them that they had committed some sort of like malfeasance that caused him to fire them. So not a healthy office. And
the extent that
it even is operational.
The extension of that is that he also knew that each of these individuals were engaging in what he claims are unethical behaviors, but wasn't telling anybody about that. Or it just doesn't make a ton of sense. It just is like the amount of rat fuckery going on in CD14 is insane.
Let's talk briefly before we go out, following up on the vacancy story that was published in Elias that we talked about last week, that was put out by a number of activist groups, Sage and Ace, and some students at UCLA Law School. That story was retracted and has not been put, the initial study that prompted the huge coverage of this story nationally has not been reissued. Alyssa, do you want to talk about that from the perspective of a journalist?
Well, this is something that does happen, I suppose, but we didn't get a whole lot of clarity from the study's author, a report, I guess it was a report, about what was happening and when. And we got initial information, you know, got it sent to us in this report. I think the publishing date that they had attached to it was November 26th and that we were getting the advanced information and whatever. And then it vanished from where it was posted.
Yeah, that was an interesting thing about the LAist retraction. They said that they had gone back to look at the report again, and it was just gone.
It was gone. And we had actually noticed that a day or two before and thought that there was something strange, because we hadn't reported it on it. We were trying to find out, to look at some of the claims. Mm-hmm. I mean, these things happen. You get this report. People have spent months or maybe years researching things, and you know, you sometimes want to just make sure that things have been reported accurately. So we were going through it, and then it was gone. And it was strange to see that it was gone. And I think what LAS did was great, is they published another story kind of going through some of the problems with the report and some of the questions that it raised. And then,
and a mea culpa for publishing.
And yeah, and saying, you know, we should have, you know, maybe checked with some other third parties on some of these claims. And then what the study's authors, the report's authors said, is that they were looking at updated vacancy information.
Because that was the big discrepancy, was they had said that there were 70% of the units across 10 or 12 buildings in downtown LA were vacant. Some of those had just opened. We talked about this last week, but a new number was closer to 30%. A few months later.
Right. And with all vacancy stuff, it's all, you can only pick a point in time. You pick like a snippet at a moment, and you, unless you were really looking at over an entire year, some of these places that only opened a few months ago, things like that. I mean, you guys discussed this and we've talked about this before, but I think the bigger problem for me, just looking at it as somebody who writes about these things and how these stories go out, that original tweet from NPR is still up.
Oh, boy.
The study, LAS corrected its story, but the tweets and the tweets upon tweets are still out there, and people will use this study, whether or not it's been taken down or whether or not it's been, you know, explored in depth or, you know, debunked or whatever, as evidence to try to convince themselves that they're, you know, we can house all the homeless people and all the vacant units in these luxury towers, which is probably not true, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because it's first of all, I really respect Matt Tinoco, friend of the show. Also, Ace and Sage are two great organizations who have been involved in really important work statewide, but also here in LA County. This is a pernicious myth. You know, this myth did not originate with either the study nor the story in LA. And I think it's hard because the reason why that's the case is because people take, they kind of inoculate themselves to any evidence to the contrary. And we've talked at length about the way that vacancy works and the way that it changes over time. But the fact of the matter is, people who are convinced that this is the case, although they will point to an ultimately erroneous study like this as evidence, I also feel like those same people would not really be opposed to making the same claims completely evidence-free.
Absolutely.
It's hard. Yeah. It's hard to say, really, what the ultimate outcome of this is going to be. I do think that LAS, like you said, handled it well in the aftermath. I feel bad for Sage and Ace in particular because they do important policy work, and this definitely does not help them as organizations which are credible and vital to tenants' rights here in LA.
Yeah, and we talked about how even if the raw numbers were accurate, which they very well may be, that there are more vacant units in LA than there are people who are homeless, that still doesn't account for anywhere close to the need for new permanently affordable housing that needs to be constructed.
Right.
So unfortunately, now this study has undermined two efforts right. at once, both right. the vacancy tax effort right. by making it seem like the need for a vacancy tax is illegitimate when it's not. We do need a vacancy tax. That is yep. good policy. And also the need for new construction of affordable housing, yep. which because the people that didn't want to build it are going to run with this number and already yep. were no matter what.
Yep.
That is our show for this week. Thank you so much for listening to LA Podcast. We will be back next week. Please stay dry. Bye-bye.